Good morning. It is 9 minutes past 7 o'clock on a Sunday morning. I want to start out, Josh, by wishing everyone a happy Mother's Day.
Mm-hmm.
You got any big plans? You going to go give your mom something nice, a plant?
No. Would be a little difficult. May have to pay a fee for that, but yeah. I know. I'll be giving her a phone call as soon as I'm done here.
Okay, good.
Yeah, phone call suffices too.
That's right. That's right. A card, flowers, or a phone call.
Yes.
So we are starting this hour. We talked about this last week a little. I kind of like the idea of health hour head to toe, right?
Oh, yeah.
We talked about eyes last week. So we're just going to stay up on the upper half of the body. And today we're going to talk about the mind. We're talking about dementia because there is a new report out on Alzheimer's and dementia. Mm-hmm. The 2025 Alzheimer's Disease Facts and Figures Report released by the Alzheimer's Association. And we have with us University of Minnesota researcher Dr. Joseph Gahler. Good morning, doctor. Thanks for coming on with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Well, it's good of you. I know that I just read that we have more than 7 million for the first time Americans who are living with Alzheimer's. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. This is the first time the number of people estimated to be living with Alzheimer's disease or related dementia has exceeded 7 million.
Wow.
So the prevalence continues to, the number of people with Alzheimer's continues to increase. And in Minnesota itself, that number has also been increasing. There's around 166,000 people thought to be living with Alzheimer's or related dementia. And so it continues to be an issue of very high public health importance.
Let's remember that our listeners can jump in if they have questions. Maybe someone you love is going through this. Maybe you are, or a friend. 651-461-9226. That's the number to call or text. 651-461-9226. We're talking about Alzheimer's in a new report that just came out. I also read that 4 in 5 Americans. Is there some way to tell if you're going to get Alzheimer's? Is there a gene?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Dementia risk is very complex. It's a mix of underlying genetic risk, but then also it appears to be just a whole number of a lifestyle and other environmental risk factors. It's thought that dementia risk overall is potentially 45% modifiable across the life course, which is a fairly high number. I mean, it's more than we would think. But with that being said, the risk factors for dementia do include whether one has a family member with Alzheimer's. There appears to be some genetic risks or links to Alzheimer's. For example, if one inherits a certain pair of the APOE4 gene. But beyond that, then one starts looking at things like education and early life. Through midlife and beyond, one's heart health, that certainly seems to have a link to brain health in terms of managing one's hypertension, diabetes, blood pressure, those kinds of things. But there are some other risk factors that have been emerging too, such as depression, managing hearing loss or other types of sensory impairments over time. And in some instances, and this is more of an emerging area of research, even air pollution and other environmental challenges. Those also may contribute to brain health over time. It's a very interesting area of research. It's one that is also emerging each day with potentially new risk factors.
651-461-9226 if you have a question for Dr. Gahler. A texter just wrote in, and it was the same thing I asked. Why or how does Alzheimer's lead to death?
Well, the progression of Alzheimer's generally, as one moves from early to middle to late stages, begins to affect some of the core functions of the body, our core ability to maintain independence, to the point where, in some cases, people can no longer swallow, can no longer really engage in core bodily functions that help keep us alive. So often, someone who's living with Alzheimer's disease, it may lead to certain other conditions that then directly lead to death, like pneumonia, as well as other issues as well.
Another
now, one thing
oh,
with
go ahead. Oh, go sorry, ahead. No, no, you finish your thought. One thing.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I think that's interesting, because of stigma, that's a really big issue. It's something maybe we don't always think about when we're thinking of Alzheimer's, but because of the stigmatization of Alzheimer's disease, nobody wants to be called someone living with Alzheimer's. And if one does have dementia, an unwillingness to share that with others, when one is actually about to die, when one dies or the decision is made, what should we put on the death certificate? You know, there's a potential that some people don't want to put Alzheimer's on the death certificate, but some other reason or cause for death. But that being said, the death rate for Alzheimer's has jumped from last year, and for a long time is the sixth leading cause, and now the fourth leading cause of death in adults.
Wow, that's interesting. Just because people don't want to admit or say, isn't that terrible? Like, there's shame around having Alzheimer's. I mean, that. Go ahead.
It is. It's very challenging because, you know, one of the things that certainly, if we're ever going to get to a point to, if not cure Alzheimer's, effectively treat it and treat the symptoms, maybe even reduce the progression of decline, the importance of early detection will be critical. Identifying potential issues with cognition, thinking, behavior as soon as possible in the disease trajectory. And that often won't happen because of stigma, because maybe one feels these are just normal changes as we get older, or this is going to happen to all of us as we get older, when in fact these aren't normal changes. These are warning signs. And number one, being aware of them and being willing to talk about them with a provider. But then also number two, having healthcare providers themselves have a willingness to talk about it, a willingness to assess for brain health and diagnosis, if not, and refer for diagnosis as necessary, is critical. But stigma gets in the way of that.
Yeah, certainly. We have some texters asking, does vitamin B12, help with dementia?
Yeah, that's a good question, too. B12, and I often get a lot of questions about other supplements, too. I want to say this and emphasize this. My mentor always said, absence of evidence doesn't mean evidence of absence. The reason why I say that is, it is always possible that sometime in the future there might show more compelling links between certain supplements and brain health or cognitive decline, like B12. Research and studies to date, and there's been several of them now, have seemed to suggest that, in fact, B12 is not protective, does not have significant effects on at least reducing risk for Alzheimer's and dementia. But that doesn't mean B12 isn't an important component for other aspects of health or other aspect of one's, well-being. So I wouldn't necessarily dissuade people, but at the same time, that's where the research stands right now, from my understanding anyway.
All right, we're going to take our first break now. It is 17 minutes past 7 o'clock on a Sunday morning. It is Mother's Day. Make sure you call your mother or get her some flowers. We're going to continue with your questions as well, 651-461-9226. We're back right after this. We are back. It is 7:20 on a Sunday morning, Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day to everyone. We're talking this hour about Alzheimer's, and a new report, 2025 Facts and Figures report, just came out with the latest information on Alzheimer's and other dementia, and some insight from a special survey that was done on new treatments and early diagnoses. We have with us on our news line Dr. Joseph Galler. He is the University of Minnesota researcher, and we invite you to be a part of the show as well. 651-461-9226, 651-461-9226. Texter writes, Dr. Galler, thanks for your program. What is your opinion of Dr. Dale Predson's program on Alzheimer's? It focuses on diet, exercise, and inflammatory efforts, I should say, anti-inflammatory efforts. Do you know of what he speaks, and what do you think?
Well, I'll speak more broadly than that particular book. Another area of interest, and you've heard me allude to this a little bit earlier on the whole aspect of risk reduction and some of the research happening there, is does a combination of what we believe are some of the risk factors, and does a combination program that manages those risk factors Does that actually reduce cognitive decline? Does it actually prevent the onset of dementia? And there's a very large study occurring now in the U.S. It's based on some very promising preliminary results that occurred I believe it was the Netherlands several years ago. The study's acronym here in the U.S. is called POINTER, POINTER. And from my understanding, and I was at the Alzheimer's Association office last week, my understanding is the results of this large trial should be released sometime this year. That'll give us a pretty significant insight into the effects of a program that combines lifestyle management, social engagement, brain healthy diet, and other of those lifestyle elements to determine, does this actually contribute to brain health as we get older? And so I eagerly await those results, as I do believe the Alzheimer's Association is too. It was a very rigorous study, and again, a study that was conducted across multiple sites in the U.S. And to directly answer that question, I would await the results of this study because it likely will give us significant insights into, again, this our ability to reduce our risk for Alzheimer's and other types of dementia.
Another texter writes, why is it so important to get diagnosed with Alzheimer's when there's not much we can do about it? And I think there's something to that. You know, you don't want to know if you can't fix it. But in this case, maybe go ahead. You can slow it down.
Yeah, I mean, this is a refrain you hear a lot from many. And I would disagree about there's nothing that can be done. Yes, Alzheimer's is progressive. It is a chronic condition. There is yet to be a cure. That being said, with the advent of some new therapeutics for Alzheimer's, and again, they are not without their caveats. I want to be very clear on that. But new therapeutics have been developed and have been approved by FDA that have actually targeted directly for the first time some of the pathology in the brain associated with Alzheimer's, specifically the accumulation of amyloid plaques. These therapies have been tested and are delivered in people with either mild cognitive impairment or the early stages of Alzheimer's disease. If we wait to have a diagnosis of Alzheimer's until in the middle or later stages of the disease, which has been the traditional approach, that would reduce the ability of these, but maybe even future therapies, to exert an effect. You add on top of that, why would we want to know sooner? I would imagine most of us want to be able to control our legal affairs, our financial affairs, other types of core and important decision making before we lose the ability to do so. And I've seen this happen in many families where the person living with dementia or Alzheimer's is no longer in a position to make these core decisions. Someone else has to make it for them. I don't think that's something any of us would want. Now, certainly there are, this is a very complex question, and it's a complex decision that many of us may have to make as we get older. There could be some downsides to knowing if you have Alzheimer's or dementia. We talked about stigma. There could be other issues, maybe with employment or for other reasons, maybe the distress it could cause. But by and large, I think the idea that we can't do anything with Alzheimer's is one we should really relegate to the dustbin. And I haven't even gotten into my whole tangent of what are community-based resources, supports, and programs that families and others could use to help them navigate the journey of Alzheimer's.
Before we get to that, I want to ask, what are the signs of Alzheimer's? And I know dementia is sort of the umbrella, and underneath is Alzheimer's, you know, sort of the whole picture. But what's about being forgetful? What are indications of Alzheimer's rather than just, you know, the aging mind?
Yeah, one of my favorite resources that the Alzheimer's Association puts out is called the 10 Warning Signs of Alzheimer's. And why it's important is the 10 Warning Signs differentiates between changes that happen that may be a warning sign versus the normal changes that can happen as we get older. Some of these changes include things like, forgetting names, forgetting the rules to a favorite board game, forgetting directions, but then not being able to remember them unless one has significant help doing so. Problems like, for example, misplacing items, forgetting where one puts them. You hear these stories of people taking car keys and putting them in the freezer, taking a banana and putting it in a clothes dresser, and then blaming others for taking their things. I mean, essentially, the theme with the warning signs is this, is information that is learned no longer can be remembered. And it's almost thinking of memory and cognition as we get older as a chain with links in it. As we get older and normally, the chain certainly rusts. All of our memory doesn't maybe function as well as it did, but the chain still holds together. We can still retrace our steps, and it may take longer and longer, but we can retrace our steps to remember things. With Alzheimer's, entire links of the chain fall off where people aren't able to recall information, and that can cause agitation, distress, and also you see these personality and behavior changes as well. Those are probably the main differences when we think of warning signs versus normal age-related changes in cognition.
651-461-9226, text coming in. Good morning. Is there a blood test to diagnose Alzheimer's?
This is a great question, and this is probably one of the big breakthroughs that have occurred really as recently as the past 12, 18 months or so. There are blood tests now available. Some people call these the blood-based biomarkers that can determine whether we have accumulation of amyloid plaque, abnormal accumulation of amyloid plaque in the brain. And this can occur, number one, before we even show symptoms of Alzheimer's, before we show potentially memory loss or other types of problems. And then number two, it can be administered not just by a specialty professional like a neurologist, but it could be administered by primary care providers. This is a pretty significant breakthrough in Alzheimer's in terms of how we assess it and how we can diagnose it. At one level, that's very exciting, but then the flip side always comes down to, well, you assess, and it's almost similar to that question that just came in. You can assess someone who might have Alzheimer's and dementia by using this blood-based biomarker, or at least be at elevated risk. Mm-hmm. But what do you do after that? And this is really where the need to understand what are resources, what are programs that are available, not just within a healthcare system, but within a community, are going to be very important for not only individuals, but for their potential care partners, often family members there as well. Mm-hmm. This can't be something where someone is assessed, they're given a blood base, you know, they're told they have elevated amyloid and say, well, you know, good luck and we'll see you in 6 months. There has to be some type of programming, educational effort that goes behind that. That's what I worry about when I think of the blood test. But there is little doubt it is a significant breakthrough. I don't know if it's FDA approved as of today. I've been looking and checking up on this. I don't believe it is. And if it's not, it's on the verge of being so. If it is FDA approved already, forgive me, listeners, but it is very close anyway to being something that could be implemented in standard practice where any of us could ask for it.
All right. We're going to take our bottom of the hour break right now. It is about 7:30. It is 651-461-9226. There are a lot of questions coming in, so we'll get to those after this on News Talk 830 WCCO. And we are back with the last half of our program today, our health hour, head to toe. That's what we're calling it. Susie Jones here, Josh Wheeler at the helm, and we have with us on our newsline Dr. Joseph Gogler. He is a University of Minnesota researcher, and we are taking your calls as we continue to talk about Alzheimer's and a recent survey and the results of a survey that was done by the Alzheimer's Association. Let's get to some more questions. There's quite a few of them. So this person writes, it used to be, I think, and you tell us, doctor, that Alzheimer's could not be definitively diagnosed until someone had died. Has that changed?
That's an excellent question. The process of diagnosis, the person asking this question is pretty much correct in that often postmortem diagnosis is used to validate the accuracy of diagnosis when one is alive. So the approach to diagnosis currently, although again that's rapidly changing with a number of new tools available, still has been more or less a process of exclusion. An important point to remember is Alzheimer's and dementia are not the same thing. Mm-hmm. Dementia is a collection of symptoms. It's an umbrella term essentially symptoms of changes in memory, behavior, language that is due to problems in the brain. Alzheimer's disease is the most common cause of dementia. Mm. And so when a diagnosis is occurring for Alzheimer's, the approach is basically to exclude all other potential causes of dementia, where then the specialist and their team is confident or fairly confident that the reason we're seeing dementia here in this person is because of Alzheimer's. Accuracy rates range from in vivo or while a diagnosis while someone is alive. I've seen some estimates, roughly 75%, but many much higher. I've seen more around the 80 to 95%. When I say specialist, I mean this was a diagnosis by a neurologist and a memory care clinic and team like that.
Yeah.
Now, that being said, you know, the advent of PET scans over the past 20 years or so, where one is able to actually see visually, is amyloid plaque accumulating in the brain and what parts of the brain, again, while we're alive. And then with new advances such as the blood-based biomarkers, again, we're moving closer and closer to having a very, very accurate diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease as a cause of dementia while we're alive. So, again, I know it's a long-winded answer to a question that seems to be straightforward, but it actually, you know, it's something that's has also been changing.
Yeah, as it all has been changing. What is the research you're doing at the U?
Yes, my research, interestingly, I focus a lot on dementia care innovation. So how can we best care for people living with dementia as well as those who help them? So our goal is really to design, to test, and evaluate, and then perhaps as importantly, to implement and disseminate these different types of innovations in the real world so they can benefit people. So we focus on different types of intervention approaches for family caregivers of people living with dementia. We've examined some technologies as they relate to helping people live with dementia at home as well as their care partners, and a variety of other of programs in that vein. And that's something we're very interested in as a research team.
And I would imagine that with an aging population, the likelihood of more people getting Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia, that's going to become more important more than ever to set a person up if they have it, right? Because is that what you're talking about? Finding ways to support that person in their life?
Yeah, I mean, one thing, and it's a statistic I misquoted earlier in the talk. There's so many statistics, mm-hmm. it's hard to keep them all in track. But mm-hmm. So, you know, again, in Minnesota, there's roughly 102,000 people who are over the age of 65 living with Alzheimer's. There's 166,000 individuals that are unpaid involved in the help of those individuals living with Alzheimer's. And so when we think of dementia care innovation, it's important, and I said this, and I think much of the research literature agrees, Alzheimer's disease is a disease of context, meaning that it doesn't just affect the person living with Alzheimer's dementia, it affects this whole network of people around them. Again, most prominently, family members who are caring and providing often long-term, very extensive help to people living with dementia over the course of the disease. And in order to best treat and address Alzheimer's disease, it often requires the involvement of that caregiver or care partner in delivering the best and optimal care. Certainly until we find a cure for Alzheimer's, which, you know, again, even with the emergence of therapies that seem to alter or maybe affect disease progression or at least some of the symptoms to some extent, there still will always be a need to understand what is the care environment, who is providing care to the person with dementia, how can we support them as well as the person living with dementia.
And that leads right into our next text question at 651-461-9226. How does a caregiver of a person with dementia find help with caregiving, respite care, etc.? I've contacted Senior Linkage, but having a hard time getting help is what I'm trying to say. And I imagine that's right in your wheelhouse.
Yeah, so I'm glad this person has called the Senior Linkage Line. For people who aren't aware, the Senior Linkage Line is the number, the 1-800 number any of us can call in Minnesota that will connect you to your local area agency on aging. There are 7 of them, I believe, across the state of Minnesota. They all cover different regions of the state. And that is a good number to call. And that number is 1-800-333-2433. Now, again, as this this questioner has indicated, there might be instances where, for whatever reasons, the programs available might not be right for them. Mm-hmm. They may not be eligible for them. So then the alternative, I would argue, or I would say, is if one has is in the place of either living with Alzheimer's and dementia, caring for someone, would be the 24/7 helpline of the Alzheimer's Association itself. 1-800-272-3900. And these are free. What the association offers are many types of programs at no cost, whether you're living with dementia, caregiver, or even know somebody who might be living with dementia. They offer free education classes, support groups that actually are open to anybody, either in person, and for many of us, it's becoming increasingly important to access these programs online. They offer those too. So in addition to the number, you can go to alts.org as well. I know the Minnesota North Dakota chapter or regional office here of the Alzheimer's Association quite well. There's a lot of great people there, and I'd recommend connecting with them too. And finally, I'll put this out there too. If you are interested in connecting with us and our team, we get a lot of these calls based on the research we do and our community outreach. You can always call me directly, Joe Gaugler, G-A-U-G-L-E-R, 612-626-2485. And if I can't address a question, one of my wonderful team members certainly can try to help as well. You can always reach out to us. And we can tell you as well some of the other outreach and educational programs we have coming up that might interest you, again, in this space of caring for someone living with dementia.
Can you repeat your number, Joe?
Sure. It's 612-626-2485. And, you know, the one thing, Susie, if it's okay, I can mention this, is on Saturday, June 13th.
Yeah.
Actually, Saturday, June 14th, pardon me.
That's okay.
At the university, we're going to have a conference called Caring for People with Memory Loss Conference. We've done this now. This is going to be our 18th year, I believe, doing this conference. It's all hands-on tools, resources for people living with dementia and those who care for them. If you can make it to campus in the McNamara Alumni Center, you get free food. It's a free conference, but you can also watch it online, too. We stream it.
Oh, that's great.
You want to learn more? Yeah, if you'd like to learn more about that, z.umn.edu/memory-loss-conference, all one word. And check that out. You can register, find out more.
Well, stay on the phone when you get off the air with Josh, and he can get that. When we put this up online, we can add that link when you can go online to WCCORadio.com, because that's important stuff. I know from watching people who have had loved ones with Alzheimer's and dementia, it's excruciating. I mean, it's really a hard, you know, if you turn around and don't pay attention for 1 minute, that person might be doing something that's dangerous, you know. I had a father-in-law many years ago who had dementia and Alzheimer's, and he left a lighter on, one of those ones to start a fire in the grill, and it burned half the house down. So,
I
mean, that's an extreme, but it's a possibility. It's a hard disease.
It's very challenging. I mean, what makes it harder for all those, you know, those things you mentioned, the behaviors that can occur, you know, nighttime disruptions, driving problems can be an issue. I mean, we had one person in a study. She was caring for her dad, and her dad drove and got lost. And the only reason why the police were able to find him was like several hours away because he ran out of gas. I mean, it's those kinds of things. And you hear this a lot, which, you know, very challenging to handle. Another thing, and a complicating factor, is the length of time the disease often lasts for people and caregivers. You know, research suggests Alzheimer's disease roughly lasts from 6 to 8 years from the point of diagnosis to when someone passes. Mm-hmm. But as we've talked about, diagnosis often happens late in the disease process. And you talk to many families, they're often caring for loved ones. It could be 10, 15 years or more.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a long road. And the more we can do to identify and find potential solutions to help people manage some of these challenges, you know, whether it has to do with, are there unobtrusive technologies that could be used to maybe help prevent, alert someone like a care partner, loved one, or someone else when some of these things are happening? Are there ways to make it easier to care for someone is important. But make no mistake, we as a country, we rely very, very heavily on this vast unpaid network of caregivers. And, to me, it necessitates a broader, more comprehensive approach where healthcare, families, and then finally community resources are brought together to do the best we can to help people live with Alzheimer's.
Very good. We're going to take our last break of the show. 651-461-9226. Sorry about that. I said it too fast. 651-461-9226. We'll also repeat some of the numbers that Dr. Gongler said. We'll be back right after. And we are back with the final segment of the big show. University of Minnesota researcher Dr. Joe Gongler is on our newsline as we talk about Alzheimer's. We don't have too much time left, but we just got a couple more questions coming in. Joe, a person writes, we have used the Alzheimer's hotline many times. We lost both our parents last year to the disease. We really struggle to find good medical care. We tried eating healthy, tried to have exercise and eating well, also struggle to find the right medications. How do you find a physician that deals with Alzheimer's specifically? They seem to be few and far between.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, this person writing in is mentioning is correct. It's challenging to find people who have, I would say, are a comprehensive approach to Alzheimer's and dementia care. One place to at least initially look is the Alzheimer's Association, as this questioner had indicated, because the local Alzheimer's Association often, at the very least, will maintain a list of those memory care clinics that one could maybe reach out to, or at least ask to have a primary care provider refer someone to get some of that more comprehensive care. But let's not sugarcoat it. Many times these clinics have a backlog. It takes a long time to get into them, but that's probably the best approach that we can take, at least in terms of seeking and trying to identify and find the right type of health care.
Joe, I'm going to jump in.
Yeah.
Is it taught in medical school? I mean, is there a special part of, you know what I mean? Is there a specialty that is just this?
Well, I mean, there's certainly neurology is one area, but, you know, I would argue, and again, I'm sure people will be out there and disagree with me, including my colleagues at the University of Minnesota. I would argue the focus of neurology tends to be very much on diagnosis and maybe the pathology happening in the disease, mm-hmm. et cetera. But is there this training into, again, this more holistic vision of, okay, we can understand and diagnose the disease, we can understand and mark its progression, but what else can we do about it? I mean, it all comes back to that initial question that comes up over and over again. And I would argue there are things we can do about it. This is where I would argue it becomes not just dementia professional skills. It comes into geriatrics mm-hmm. Specialization skills. And again, geriatrics as a subspecialty discipline in many medical schools, either one isn't available. There are some certain exceptions to that across the country. But really, in terms of incorporating that type of training, not just into our future doctors, but really all of the health professionals in terms of, you know, how do you work with an aging patient? How do you help support their care partners and such? I believe has a long way to go. Yeah. Obviously, for many incoming students, thinking of working with older people might not be what they're interested in or what comes to mind. But almost inevitably, for many of these healthcare professionals, they are going to be working with older people. I mean, in Minnesota itself, there are more people over the age of 65 now than there are those 18 and under. It's the first time in recorded history, and many other states are in that situation as well. You will be working with older people, so the training should become more robust because of it.
I wonder if it will, in fact, become more robust. Is there money in geriatrics? Is there not money? I know that sadly drives people in terms of what they specialize in.
Absolutely, there is not. I mean, there is not at all, and that's largely due to, again, how the type of care that someone who provides geriatrics is incentivized in our U.S. healthcare system. To find a geriatrician is to find a gem, mm-hmm. You know, in terms of, you know, almost all the geriatricians I've ever met and worked with are people I would want to say, for example, have had my parents receive care for. I'm sure others hopefully feel the same way. Mm-hmm. But the issue is no, it's not, because, again, what great geriatric care often focuses on those things that aren't incentivized necessarily, like deprescribing. getting older people not on more medications, but taking them off the ones that are, interacting and causing more health problems.
Right, confusion.
It takes time, it takes coordination, and a lot of times these things aren't always necessarily incentivized nor prioritized in many healthcare systems. I will note this, at the University of Minnesota, at one point it had a very strong, it was small, but a really good group of people in a geriatrics. There was a formal geriatrics program at the University of Minnesota that was then shut down by the medical school in 1999. Now there has been a large donation by the Masonic family and their foundation, I believe, that hopefully will restart that again.
It seems counterintuitive in a world that we're aging that we would reduce resources to treat that next population, and we have about a minute left.
Yeah, and when you look at geriatrics, and again, focused on dementia, and which I think is all part of this conversation, the outcomes that matter to us often are influenced by good comprehensive geriatrics and or dementia care. Things like being able to stay at home longer, things like avoiding adverse events, hospitalizations, other types of problems. The issue is how can we implement those programs and make them more readily accessible as well as incentivized?
Yeah. It's been so great. Thank you so much for coming on. We got some great questions, and I'm sure we'll, if you don't mind, we like to say we'll keep you in the bullpen, keep you in our list, and come back.
Sure, no problem.
Really, this is something that we will continue to watch and talk about because it will force us to, because it's right in front of us and it's not going anywhere. So thank you so much, Joe.
Thank you, Susie, for having me on, and thank you for all the great questions from the audience.
Awesome. Dr. Joseph Gogler, University of Minnesota researcher, talking about a new survey on Alzheimer's, 2025 Alzheimer's Disease Facts and Figures Report. We're going to put this whole interview up online, so if you want to go back and listen, please do. And your money is this.